you're the COO of the Professional Collegiate League, and we've had conversations with numerous people about this G League Select team and more potential student athletes deciding to go away from the NCAA route. What can you tell us about the league you're a part of, and how does it different? How is it different from the G League Select team, and what exactly the benefits are for collegiate players?
Well, it's another option. Right now, currently, young guys don't have. They're the ones with the fewest amount of choices at the high school, transitioning into college level. What we want to do is we want to provide an athletic and an academic opportunity that is not tied solely to a very restricted and what we feel like is an exploitative system. There are players that are making the choice to go, you know, professional and take other options. We just feel like we've created an option, giving guys another choice. There was over 700 guys in the transfer portal alone in the NCAA, so we know that guys are looking for different outlets. And there's opportunities for players, or there will be opportunities for players that are just considered with the currency.
Yeah, that's it's really fascinating from a couple of standpoints. Like, we were talking to we've talked to Penny Hardaway and to Patrick Ewing recently just about how recruiting is going to have to change in this era, and how the approach is going to have to change now that the G League does exist. When you guys started this out, was this a lot of tea leaf reading, knowing that the NCAA was going to change its policies in terms of guys being able to profit off of their names and the G League entering the picture? Like, did any of these things really affect you or catch you off guard?
No, I think with the G League, we anticipated them making a move because obviously, you know, they want the cream of the crop. But again, they're going toward a completely professional system. What we want to make sure is we distinguish ourselves as a college system, a place that athletes can come, grow, develop, but on a different track. Games in the summer, full academic in the fall, winter, and spring, with development, training, and personal skill development, another life skill development category mixed in there. So we created our model with the anticipation that we were going to bring our model to the market regardless of what others in the space sort of did.
So how did this come about? How did you involve yourself in this?
I was introduced to it before I retired by a teammate of mine. And I was introduced to his brother. And his brother basically was like, look, man, these guys have a plan. It's a serious issue that needs to be addressed. We need to create other opportunities because there's so many athletes that get taken advantage of, so many athletes that just haven't found, you know, their niche. And we don't think that, you know, again, because of the way the system is designed, the athletes are the ones that bear the brunt of the responsibility when things don't go right. Right? They're the ones that are penalized. They're the ones that, you know, have to take detours and create these different methodologies to get their careers and their academic and athletic careers back on track. And we want to avoid all that. We want to make sure that, you know, we provide an opportunity for players that are discontented with the current system and are seeking a new path.
Yeah, it's really weird right now, especially because we just finished watching The Last Dance. I don't know if you watched the entire thing, but, you know, they're showing Michael Jordan doing his 3 years. Okay, yeah. I mean, it's hard to imagine anyone really wasn't that has ever picked up a basketball before.
Yeah,
or
owns a television, yes. Yeah.
yeah. Oh, you have a TV, David? You use some of those millions
Things
of dollars that you've
well,
tried to buy a television. So congratulations on your TV. I hope it's a flat screen. I hope it's HD. So, but we're watching. It's like, man, Michael is in college for 3 years. And he really thought about coming back for a fourth, and it's those weird things. I can't imagine it now, unless you're like with Coach Cal or something, where your coach would be telling you, listen, man, you have to go to the pros. Like, you got to do this. Like, please go. We can't do anything else for you. Versus now where, we are pivoting to a world where the G League is saying, hey, we'll give you 100 grand. We'll give you 200 grand. You come here. We'll professionalize you right away. Do you have any reservations about this? Because, again, obviously you're still passionate about the education. Do you think that maybe we're in all of the anger that people have felt towards the way the NCAA has exploited, especially student athletes who have really, really valuable, that we've sort of lost a little bit the value of actually having that collegiate experience and getting an education.
Right. So I would say, I guess there's degrees to all of this. There is value, obviously, in learning. There's value in education. But the way that things are currently constructed, very few athletes get to truly pursue, you know, I would say, an opportunity to really get the most out of their academic experience on these campuses, simply because it totally revolves around their basketball or their football or their sport. And the majority of their time is spent toward that sport. Their schedule, their academic coursework is aligned around that sport. So most times you have players that are just in the environment to make sure that they're eligible to play basketball. So I think it's, you know, the experience is a total other thing. You know, being on campus, life, you know, growing with other, you know, peers in your sort of demographic, that's something that I think will always be special. I think that's what some kids are dreading not having right this fall, you know, depending on what some universities decide to do. If they're not letting people back on campus in their classrooms, it takes away from the experience of college. But I think we have to be careful recognizing what the guys are actually getting versus what they're being, or at least what we're talking about in the media and what people think they're receiving from a public perception standpoint.
Talking to David West, two-time NBA champion, and you mentioned that you watched Last Dance because you do not live underneath a rock. But yeah, I'm sure you'd heard a lot of those stories from Steve Kerr playing under him for a couple of years with the Warriors. How much of that was new? Like, it's we'd also heard the stories of getting punched out by Michael. How much of that? How much conversation did you guys have with Steve? Like, how many stories were shared during your time playing under Steve?
He always used his Bulls experience to relay messages, particularly after we won the first championship and we won the second one. He talked to us about the pressures of winning back-to-back championships and shared a lot of his personal experience. That's one of Steve's strengths, is he's able to personalize his communication, so you know he's always coming from, you know, his particular point of view. And usually from a very humble perspective. But, you know, none of that in terms of, you know, the story with his father, we had a conversation about that. So that wasn't necessarily new. It was good to see, see the other side. I think that's what I got out of the whole documentary, was to see sort of the other components around Jordan, which I thought was very fascinating, you know, to see how, I don't remember. I was like in high school doing that stuff, so I was a fan, but I don't remember. You know, I think it was very telling that Michael was so adamant about playing for Phil Jackson. I think in this world, you haven't seen many guys, maybe with Duncan and Popovich, maybe would be the last one where you see a player sort of committed to the coach, committed to the philosophy, to the degree that, right, Mike said, I'm done if I'm not playing for Phil. So I thought that was a very telling part about who he was. You know, there were a couple scenes where he was, you know, being, I think, a professional listener, which I don't think I knew. Right, there's one scene where he's standing there and Phil Jackson is talking, and he's staring at Phil Jackson with like this intensity. And I thought that was pretty impressive, because that's the side of him that we don't necessarily see. And then also how, you know, the other thing that was, I think, probably the most astonishing thing to me was how personable he was with the people in the arenas. You know, that was something that, you know, you wouldn't expect Michael Jordan to be like that. And I'm not saying that to slight him personally, but it's just, again, that's not something that we saw from the public persona, the personal relationships that he developed with, you know, the arena folks, the security people. I thought that was very, very telling of how genuine he is.
Yeah. Wright Thompson just wrote a really great piece about Jordan's backstory on ESPN. And one of the sons of the security guards was just, he has a quote basically, Michael is loyal as hell. And if you're in his circle, it's basically a tribe. And that those guys became very close to him. I agree. That was one of my favorite parts of the doc too, just seeing that those guys, these former cops, became Jordan's essentially best friends, and that he connected with them on a different level, but that they were actually friends. Like, imagine doing a shoulder shrug to Michael Jordan if you were a player, right? Like, imagine doing that to him if you're on the court, and then you've got his security guards doing the double shoulder shrug to him while they're playing games and taking his money. And I, based on his personality, it seems, yeah, it seems pretty clear that that would have pissed him off. But the one, it does make sense to a degree because, man, Michael's so famous and people are just trying to get at him, and here are his protectors. And no one can even fathom that level of fame and celebrity, and because it was so big, seeing those crowds outside of the hotels. But the one team that it does get kind of compared to is the Warriors teams that you were on, just in terms of being a traveling circus where everyone wants a piece of something, that Steph Curry quickly becomes one of the faces of the NBA, if not the face of the NBA, even ahead of somebody like LeBron in terms of most recognizable for a short period of time. When you consider doing this, obviously basketball was your primary focus. You wanted to win a championship. You went to this really great team. You fit in. But how much of it was just, oh my God, this is just a different experience from normal day-to-day NBA life, just the level of celebrity that this team has, or was it?
No, it was. It absolutely was. I thought the fan base there in Oakland and in the Bay Area is one of the more rabid fan bases. I mean, they're intense about their teams and their support. But, you know, the national attention, we played almost, I think, 70 games on national television the year, my first season there, and then maybe 68 the following year. So just having that kind of exposure every night, basically getting everybody's best shot, because everybody, you know, when you go into the arena, everybody is usually the biggest night or the biggest game that team has had because of the amount of media that's going to be there. It's beyond the local media, national media, international media is traveling. So, yeah, it was quite an experience. But the one thing through it all, you know, those guys are able to maintain a level of professionalism and focus to block it all out, you know, handle it about as well as you can handle it, and then live up to all the pressure.
Before I let you go, David, yeah, you were pretty shocked that Kevin Durant decided to leave the Warriors when he did. But now that we've seen, we've got a little separation from that decision, and we've seen some of the backfighting, especially on podcasts between Draymond and KD. Is it any less surprising? Do you feel the same way as initially when you heard the news?
Yeah, I just, it's probably what I expected. You know, both of those guys are, have a full of pride and ego. They want to win. They're super competitive. Again, they're just in a mode where I thought that there was a lot of pressure on them. They're grown men, and they handle things the way that they feel like they need to be handled. So, and my hope is that, they understand the run that they had together was special. They're able to continue to tack on great moments to their individual careers and continue to highlight, the contribution that they each have made to the game. So I think ultimately that's what it comes down to. They both have a positive impact, and they'll get past it at some point.
Well, the interesting thing is going to be now. It's funny, everyone's looking at The Last Dance and saying, well, what's the next sports documentary? What's the next thing? And, like, Tom Brady's already got one that's announced, and they're going to do one on Lance Armstrong. So they're going to become more and more the norm. But this weirdly already made me excited for whatever the Warriors version of The Last Dance is. Like, to see David West, you're going to be sitting in the compound, maybe with a Michael Jordan-esque cigar. Sitting there, like, what are they going to come to David West for in the documentary? What's going to be the number one thing that you think that you're like, oh man, what, you're definitely going to ask me about this?
It'll probably be what, probably some of the stuff that we went through behind the scenes, and I'm sure they picked up some of that stuff because they had cameras rolling everywhere. So it'll probably be some of the just behind the scenes stuff, some of the, the heated moments we had in practice, some of the stories, backstories behind some of these guys, some of these awesome games that they had. There's a lot of backstory to some of them, so I think that'll be probably the most interesting thing.
At your practices, did Steph and KD like to play or frequently play on different teams?
Every now and then, he would.
Did you feel like...
They would put him... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, did you feel like that in those moments that those guys were like, yeah, let's have this out. Let's see whose team wins. That those things felt like they had a little higher stakes.
Well, it was you know, usually it's Steph are on the same team. Everybody else kind of got mixed up. So KD would play with the second unit. Draymond would play with the second unit. Clay and Steph were always together, but whenever they would split, it was always interesting watching them compete against each other. So that's something that I think people don't understand. That was a good dynamic in their natural competition. Just watching them, that's probably one of the more memorable things, is watching those guys and the diligent workers that they are. But again, sort of setting the tone, setting the example. Because the minute they were separated, Clay's on one team, Steph's on the other, the competition, the competitiveness kicked up, right? It doesn't matter who's on the other side. You know, Clay's trying to win, Steph's trying to win.
Who do you think won more games?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
I was really hoping you were going to say Clay.
Hopefully you have a different answer when they come to you for the doc, David, because they're going to ask the same question.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was your trial run.
Right.
David, this is a lot of fun. Thanks for doing this, man.
Thanks, man. Be well.
Absolutely. Thank you.